"Fear not," said a strange voice behind him. Frodo turned and saw Strider, and yet not Strider, for the weather-worn ranger was no longer there. In the stern sat Aragorn, son of Arathorn, proud and erect, guiding the boat with skillful strokes. His hood was cast back, and his dark hair was blowing in the wind. A light was in his eyes, a king returning from exile to his own land. "Fear not," he said. "Long have I desired to look upon the likenesses of Isildur and Anarion, my sires of old. Under their shadow, Elessar, the Elfstone son of Arathorn of the house of Valandil, Isildur's son, heir of Elendil, has naught to dread." Then the light of his eyes faded, and he spoke to himself.
"Would that Gandalf were here! How my heart yearns for Minas Anor and the walls of my own city! But whither now shall I go?"
The chasm was long and dark, and filled with a noise of wind and rushing water and echoing stone. It bent somewhat towards the west, so that at first all was dark ahead, but soon Frodo saw a tall gap of light before him, ever growing. Swiftly it drew near, and suddenly the boat shot through, out into a wide, clear light. The sun, already long fallen from the noon, was shining in a windy sky. The pent water spread out into a long oval lake, pale Nen Hithoil, fenced by steep grey hills whose sides were clad with trees, but their heads were bare, cold gleaming in the sunlight. At the far southern end rose three peaks. The midmost stood somewhat forward from the others and sundered from them, an island in the waters, about which the flowing river flung pale, shimmering arms. Distant but deep, there came up on the wind a roaring sound like the roll of thunder heard far away.
"Behold, tall Brandir," said Aragorn, pointing south to the tall peak. "Upon the left stands Armon Hlor, and upon the right is Armon Hen, the hills of hearing and of sight. In the days of the great kings there were high seats upon them, and watch was kept there. But it is said that no foot of man or beast has ever been set upon tall Brandir. Ere the shade of night falls we shall come to them. I hear the endless voice of Raros calling."
The company rested now for a while, drifting south on the current that flowed through the middle of the lake. They ate some food, and then they took to their paddles and hastened on their way. The sides of the westward hills fell into shadow, and the sun grew round and red. Here and there a misty star peered out. The three peaks loomed before them, darkling in the twilight. Rauros was roaring with a great voice. Already night was laid on the flowing waters when the travellers came at last under the shadow of the hills. The tenth day of their journey was over. Wilderland was behind them. They could go no further without choice between the east way and the west. The last stage of the quest was before them. Chapter 10. The Breaking of the Fellowship. Aragorn led them to the right arm of the river. Here upon its western side, under the shadow of Tol Brandir, a green lawn ran down to the water from the feet of Armon Hen. Behind it rose the first gentle slopes of the hill clad with trees, and trees marched away westward along the curving shores of the lake. A little spring fell tumbling down and fed the grass.
"Here we will rest tonight," said Aragorn. "This is the lawn of Parth Garlan, a fair place in the summer days of old. Let us hope that no evil has yet come here." They drew up their boats on the green banks, and beside them they made their camp. They set a watch, but had no sight nor sound of their enemies. If Gollum had contrived to follow them, he remained unseen and unheard. Nonetheless, as the night wore on, Aragorn grew uneasy, tossing often in his sleep and waking. In the small hours he got up and came to Frodo, whose turn it was to watch.
"Why are you waking?" asked Frodo. "It is not your watch."
"I don't know," answered Aragorn, "but a shadow and a threat has been growing in my sleep. It would be well to draw your sword."
"Why?" said Frodo.
Are enemies at hand? Let us see what sting may show, answered Aragorn. Frodo then drew the elf blade from its sheath. To his dismay, the edges gleamed dimly in the night. Orcs, he said. Not very near, and yet too near, it seems.
I feared as much, said Aragorn, but maybe they are not on this side of the river. The light of Sting is faint, and it may point to no more than spies of Mordor roaming on the slopes of Arman Hlor. I have never heard before of orcs upon Arman Head. Yet who knows what may happen in these evil days, now that Minas Tirith no longer holds secure the passages of Anduin. We must go warily tomorrow.
The day came like fire and smoke. Low in the east there were black bars of cloud like the fumes of a great burning. The rising sun lit them from beneath with flames of murky red, but soon it climbed above them into a clear sky. The summit of Tol Brandir was tipped with gold. Frodo looked out eastward and gazed at the tall island. Its sides sprang sheer out of the running water. High up above the tall cliffs were steep slopes upon which trees climbed, mounting one head above another, and above them again were grey faces of inaccessible rock, crowned by a great spire of stone. Many birds were circling about it, but no sign of other living things could be seen. When they had eaten, Aragorn called the company together.
"The day has come at last," he said, "the day of choice, which we have long delayed. What shall now become of our company that has travelled so far in fellowship? Shall we turn west with Boromir and go to the wars of Gondor, or turn east to the fear and shadow, or shall we break up our fellowship and go this way and that, as each may choose? Whatever we do must be done soon. We cannot long halt here. The enemy is on the eastern shore, we know, but I fear that the orcs may already be on this side of the water." There was a long silence, in which no one spoke or moved.
"Well, Frodo," said Aragorn at last, "I fear that the burden is laid upon you. You are the bearer appointed by the council. Your own way you alone can choose. In this matter I cannot advise you. I am not Gandalf, and though I have tried to bear his part, I do not know what design or hope he had for this hour, if indeed he had any. Most likely it seems that if he were here now, the choice would still wait on you. Such is your fate."
Frodo didn't answer at once. Then he spoke slowly. "I know that haste is needed, yet I cannot choose. The burden is heavy. Give me an hour longer, and I will speak. Let me be alone." Aragorn looked at him with kindly pity.
"Very well, Frodo, son of Drogo," he said. "You shall have an hour, and you shall be alone. We will stay here for a while, but do not stray far or out of call."
Frodo sat for a moment with his head bowed. Sam, who had been watching his master with great concern, shook his head and muttered,
"Plain as a pikestaff it is, but it's no good Sam Gamgee putting in his spoke just now."
Presently Frodo got up and walked away, and Sam saw that while the others restrained themselves and did not stare at him, the eyes of Boromir followed Frodo intently until he passed out of sight in the trees at the foot of Arman Hen. Wandering aimlessly at first in the wood, Frodo found that his feet were leading him up towards the slopes of the hill. He came to a path, the dwindling ruins of a road of long ago. In steep places stairs of stone had been hewn, but now they were cracked and worn, and split by the roots of trees. For some while he climbed, not caring which way he went, until he came to a grassy place. Rowan trees grew about it, and in the midst was a wide flat stone. The little upland lawn was open upon the east, and was filled now with the early sunlight. Frodo halted and looked out over the river, far below him, to Tol Brandir and the birds wheeling in the great gulf of air between him and the untrodden isle. The voice of Rauros was a mighty roaring mingled with a deep throbbing boom.
He sat down upon the stone and cupped his chin in his hands, staring eastwards, but seeing little with his eyes. All that had happened since Bilbo left the Shire was passing through his mind, and he recalled and pondered everything that he could remember of Gandalf's words. Time went on, and still he was no nearer to a choice. Suddenly he awoke from his thoughts. A strange feeling came to him that something was behind him, that her friendly eyes were upon him. He sprang up and turned, but all that he saw to his surprise was Boromir, and his face was smiling and kind.
"I was afraid for you, Frodo," he said, coming forward. "If Aragorn is right and orcs are near, then none of us should wander alone, and you least of all. So much depends on you. And my heart, too, is heavy. May I stay now and talk for a while, since I've found you? It would comfort me. Where there are so many, all speech becomes a debate without end, but two together may perhaps find wisdom."
"You are kind," answered Frodo, "but I don't think that any speech will help, for I know what I should do, but I'm afraid of doing it, Boromir. Afraid." Boromir stood silent. Rauros roared endlessly on. The wind murmured in the branches of the trees. Frodo shivered. Suddenly Boromir came and sat beside him.
"Are you sure that you do not suffer needlessly?" he said. "I wish to help you. You need counsel in your hard choice. Will you not take mine?"
"I think I know already what counsel you would give, Boromir," said Frodo, "and it would seem like wisdom but for the warning of my heart."
"Warning? Warning against what?"
said Boromir sharply. "Against delay. Against the way that seems easier. Against refusal of the burden that is laid on me. Against, well, if it must be said, against trust in the strength and truth of men."
"Yet that strength has long protected you far away in your little country, though you knew it not."
"I don't doubt the valor of your people, but the world is changing. The walls of Minas Tirith may be strong, but they are not strong enough. If they fail, what then?"
"We shall fall in battle valiantly, but there is still hope that they will not fail."
"No hope while the ring lasts," said Frodo.
"Ah, the ring," said Boromir, his eyes lighting. "The ring, is it not a strange fate that we should suffer so much fear and doubt for so small a thing? So small a thing! And I have seen it only for an instant in the house of Elrond. Could I not have a sight of it again?"
Frodo looked up. His heart went suddenly cold. He caught the strange gleam in Boromir's eyes, yet his face was still kindly and friendly. "It is best that it should lie hidden," he answered.
"As you wish. I care not," said Boromir. "Yet may I not even speak of it? For you seem ever to think only of its power in the hands of the enemy, of its evil uses, not of its good. The world is changing, you say. Minas Tirith will fall if the ring lasts. But why? Certainly, if the ring were with the enemy. But why if it were with us?"
"Were you not at the council?" answered Frodo. "Because we cannot use it, and what is done with it turns to evil."
Boromir got up and walked about impatiently. "So you go on," he cried. "Gandalf, Elrond, all these folk of torture to say so. For themselves they may be right. These elves and half-elves and wizards, they would come to grief, perhaps. Yet often I doubt if they are wise and not merely timid. But each to his own kind. True-hearted men, they will not be corrupted. We of Minas Tirith have been staunch through long years of trial. We do not desire the power of wizard lords, only strength to defend ourselves, strength and a just cause. And behold, in our need chance brings to light the ring of power. It's a gift, I say, a gift to the foes of Mordor. It's mad not to use it, to use the power of the enemy against him. The fearless, the ruthless, these alone will achieve victory. What could not a warrior do in this hour, a great leader? What could not Aragorn do? Or, if he refuses, why not Boromir? The ring would give me power of command. How I would drive the hosts of Mordor, and all men would flock to my banner.
Boromir strode up and down, speaking ever more loudly. Almost he seemed to have forgotten Frodo, while his talk dwelt on walls and weapons and the mustering of men, and he drew plans for great alliances and glorious victories to be, and he cast down Mordor, and became himself a mighty king, benevolent and wise. Suddenly he stopped and waved his arms.
"And they tell us to throw it away," he cried. "I do not say destroy it. That might be well, if reason could show any hope of doing so. It does not. The only plan that is proposed to us is that a halfling should walk blindly into Mordor and offer the enemy every chance of recapturing it for himself. Folly! Surely you see it, my friend," he said, turning now suddenly to Frodo again. "You say that you're afraid. If it's so, the boldest should pardon you, but is it not really your good sense that revolts?"
"No, I'm afraid," said Frodo, "simply afraid. But I'm glad to have heard you speak so fully. My mind is clearer now."
"Then you will come to Minas Tirith?" cried Boromir.
His eyes were shining and his face eager. "You misunderstand me," said Frodo.
"But you will come, at least for a while," Boromir persisted. "My city is not far now, and it's little further from there to Mordor than from here. We've been long in the wilderness, and you need news of what the enemy is doing before you can make a move. Come with me, Frodo," he said. "You need rest before your venture, if go you must."
He laid his hand on the hobbit's shoulder in friendly fashion, but Frodo felt the hand trembling with suppressed excitement. He stepped quickly away, and eyed with alarm the tall man, nearly twice his height, and many times his match in strength.
"Why are you so unfriendly?" said Boromir. "I'm a true man, neither thief nor tracker. I need your ring. That you know now. But I give you my word that I don't desire to keep it. Will you not at least let me make trial of my plan? Lend me the ring."
"No, no," cried Frodo. "The council laid it upon me to bear it."
"It's by our own folly that the enemy will defeat us," cried Boromir. "How it angers me! Fool, obstinate fool, running willfully to death and ruining our cause. If any mortals have claim to the ring, it is the men of Numenor and not halflings. It is not yours save by unhappy chance. It might have been mine. It should be mine. Give it to me!"
Frodo did not answer, but moved away till the great flat stone stood between them.
"Come, come, my friend," said Boromir in a softer voice. "Why not get rid of it? Why not be free of your doubt and fear? You can lay the blame on me, if you will. You can say that I was too strong and took it by force. For I'm too strong for you, halfling!"
he cried, and suddenly he sprang over the stone and leapt at Frodo. His fair and pleasant face was hideously changed. A raging fire was in his eyes. Frodo dodged aside and again put the stone between them. There was only one thing he could do. Trembling, he pulled out the ring upon its chain and quickly slipped it on his finger, even as Boromir sprang at him again. The man gasped, stared for a moment amazed, and then ran wildly about, seeking here and there among the rocks and trees.
"Miserable trickster!" he shouted. "Let me get my hands on you. Now I see your mind. You will take the ring to Sauron and sell us all. You have only waited your chance to leave us in the lurch. Curse you and all halflings to death and darkness!"
Then, catching his foot on a stone, he fell sprawling and lay upon his face. For a while he was as still as if his own curse had struck him down. Then suddenly he wept. He rose and passed his hand over his eyes, dashing away the tears.
"What have I said?" he cried. "What have I done? Frodo! Frodo!" he called. "Come back! A madness took me, but it has passed. Come back!"
There was no answer. Frodo did not even hear his cries. He was already far away, leaping blindly up the path to the hilltop. Terror and grief shook him, seeing in his thought the mad, fierce face of Boromir and his burning eyes. Soon he came out alone on the summit of Armon Hen and halted, gasping for breath. He saw, as through a mist, a wide, flat circle, paved with mighty flags, and surrounded with a crumbling battlement, and in the middle, set upon four carven pillars, was a high seat, reached by a stair of many steps. Up he went and sat upon the ancient chair, feeling like a lost child that had clambered upon the throne of mountain kings. At first he could see little. He seemed to be in a world of mist, in which there were only shadows. The ring was upon him. Then here and there the mist gave way, and he saw many visions, small and clear, as if they were under his eyes upon a table, and yet remote. There was no sound, only bright living images. The world seemed to have shrunk and fallen silent. He was sitting upon the seat of seeing, on Armon Hen, the hill of the Eye of the Men of Numenor.